And this is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, like everybody else in this town, we're sitting home. So it gave me the opportunity to do a lot more research for this show. And I came up with a lot of other very bizarre crimes. For example, Albert Anastasia worked with a longshoreman where his ankle problem became apparent when he killed a fellow workman. He served 18 months for that crime because all the witnesses disappeared. If he could have made the body disappear, he wouldn't have served any time. Well, Anastasia often worked with a man named Lucky Luciano. Luciano made his bid for power. It was rumored Anastasia was the Lord High Executioner for him. And when the commission, La Cosa Nostra, this thing of ours, was set up, Anastasia helped head up its enforcement arm, which was known as Murder Incorporated. Well, Murder Inc. is said to have killed hundreds of people on the orders of La Cosa Nostra. Anastasia was never prosecuted for any of the killings because witnesses always disappeared. 1951, Anastasia became boss of the Gambino crime family, one of the largest in New York. And he managed to do that by killing the family's former boss and staying in the good graces of mafioso Frank Costello, who probably allied himself with Anastasia out of fear. Well, Anastasia's ties with the Longshoremen's Union certainly helped him grow rich and powerful, but he got a little bit too carried away in his killings, even for the mob. In fact, his enemies whispered he was too crazy to be a crime boss. And Vito Genovese wanted to be the boss of all bosses. And Anastasia, of course, was in his way. Well, in 1957, as he sat in the barber chair getting a trim, somebody walked in and shot Anastasia. Newspapers proclaimed the mob's worst murderer finally got the chair, so to speak. Well, in September 2009, narcotics investigators in Polk County, Florida, searched the home of a known drug trafficker. Removing weapons and drugs and stolen goods, several officers passed the time of taking part in a virtual bowling tournament on the suspect's Wii video game system. Now, the police officers competed fiercely, stopping their search when their turn came up. And little did they know their activities had been recorded by a wireless security system that the drug dealer had set up to watch for intruders. Well, a local TV station got hold of the footage and aired clips of the cops giving each other high fives and distracting their fellow bowlers with lewd gestures. Lakeland Police Chief Roger Boatner said, "This is not the type of behavior we condone." Well, despite his attorney's claims the search was improper, the crime boss was still sentenced to 3 years in prison. The story didn't say who won the bowling tournament. Well, for sure, if somebody's telling a lie. Now, if it's an attorney you're dealing with, if his lips are moving, you know he's lying. But most experts agree the answer is no. But that hadn't stopped people from trying. Now, the Bedouins of the Arabian Peninsula forced suspected liars to lick red-hot pokers with their tongues on the assumption that liars would burn their tongues and truth-tellers wouldn't. Well, that method was cruel, but it may have had some merit since the procedure measured the moisture content of the suspect's mouth. And dry mouths are often associated with nervousness caused by lying. At the same time, how many of us could produce enough moisture in our mouths to keep from burning our tongues on red-hot pokers? Well, the ancient British used a similar trick. They fed suspects a large trial slice of bread and cheese and watched to see if they could swallow it. If a suspect's mouth was too dry to swallow, he was declared a liar and punished. Now, in my particular case, since I don't like cheese and actually medically can't eat cheese, I'd have had an issue. Well, in India, the preferred method was to send the suspects into a dark room, have them pull on the tail of a sacred donkey, which was supposed to bray if that person was dishonest. At least that's what the suspects were told. The way the system really worked was the investigators dusted the donkey's tails with black powder. Investigators figured innocent people would pull the tail without hesitation, but the guilty person, figuring nobody could see him in the dark, would only pretend to pull the tail but wouldn't touch it at all. Of course, nobody bothered to consult the donkey. Well, in 1895, the first modern lie detector was invented by Cesare Lombroso, an Italian criminologist. And his device measured changes in pulse and blood pressure. 1914, another researcher named Vittorio Benussi invented a machine that measured changes in breathing rate. But it wasn't until 1921 that John Larson, a medical student, invented a machine that measured pulse and blood pressure and breathing rates simultaneously. And his machine became known as a polygraph because it measured three types of physiological changes. Today's polygraphs use these methods as well as more sophisticated measurements. But still, I have seen people beat lie detectors. Now, modern-day lie detectors are pretty sophisticated, but they've got the same flaw the ancient methods did. They assume liars will have some kind of involuntary physical response when they lie. But according to experts, that isn't necessarily the case. Still, many people believe the polygraph's a useful tool when used in concert with other investigative methods. Plato Cicerus, another defense lawyer, said it's a great psychological tool. You take the average guy and tell him you're going to give him a polygraph, and he's concerned enough to believe it a disclosed deception on his part. Now, Cicerus is famous for having represented Aldrich Ames, a CIA spy who passed a lie detector test in 1991, and then he went on to sell more than $2.5 million worth of secrets to the Russians before he was finally caught in 1994. Now, sometimes they always say what goes around comes around, and sometimes crooks get a dose of karma. And sometimes it's instant, and sometimes it's just absolutely funny. In 2003, two men attempted to break into a bank in Kansas City. Police saw the two thieves running down a street with crowbars in their hands and drove after them into a grassy field. When they lost sight of the fleeing suspects, the officers got out of the car, and then they heard moans. And one of the robbers was hiding in the grass, and the police drove over him. He suffered only a scrape on his forehead, but still, he was in some pain. Then an inmate in a Missouri jail tried to run away. The escapee ran into the prison's darkened parking garage and headed for an open door. While he turned around, gave the approaching deputies a salute and dashed through the door. Ran headfirst into the brick wall that was behind the door. Deputies took the unconscious man to the nearby hospital. Well, Wanton Beckwith, 27, stole a car in May of 2003. After a high-speed chase by police, he ran into a nearby house to hide. The home's occupant pointed a samurai sword at the intruder, led him back outside, and held him at sword's point until the police arrived. I wonder if he made any cutting remarks. Well, you know, it's said if you gamble with ruthless gangsters, be ready to pay up, win or lose. Well, Arnold the Brain Rothstein was one of the earliest leaders of American organized crime. Now, he wasn't a gun-toting mobster. He was a planner, a bankroller, and a political fixer. Instead of muscle, he used brains to forge alliances between underworld factions and crooked politicians. And he kept a very low profile in finance bootlegging operations. He was also a compulsive gambler. In September 1928, he got into a high-stakes poker game run by a man named George McManus. The game lasted for 2 days, and Rothstein lost $320,000. Well, he claimed the game was fixed and refused to pay up. Well, on November 4th, Rothstein got an urgent phone call from McManus to meet him at the Park Central Hotel. Now, the Park Central Hotel was located across the street from Carnegie Hall. And this was a very ritzy hotel and is one of Manhattan's most popular spots. And it was a very public place. So Rothstein felt he'd be safe. Well, hotel employees later found him in a stairwell holding his abdomen. He'd been shot.
Well, was it because of the debt? Or one of his rivals simply found an excuse to eliminate him? Nobody knows for sure, because in the one day that Rothstein lived, every time police asked him who shot him, he said, "My Mutta did it." We never found anybody named Mutta. Well, let's talk about one of England's most mysterious serial killers. Between 1968 and 1969, three women, ages 25, 29, and 32, were murdered in Glasgow, Scotland. Each had been raped and then strangled. And there was a clue that tied all three killings together. All three victims were menstruating at the time of their deaths. Sanitary napkins had been placed near their bodies, near purses, but not the contents of the purses were stolen by the killer. And most bizarrely, they all met their murderer at the very same location, the Barrel Inn Ballroom. According to the police, several people actually saw the killer on the night of the third murder. Helen Puddock, 29, had gone to Barrel Inn with her sister Jean, and they met a man there who introduced himself as John. And after spending more than an hour together at the club, they all three left in a taxi. The taxi first dropped Jean off at her house, then dropped Helen off and the man off at Helen's house. Helen was found dead in her backyard the next day. Jean told police the man had quoted the Old Testament during the taxi ride, leading the media to call him Bible John. 2007, a Scottish man named Peter Tobin was convicted of the murders of three young women in Scotland and England between 1991 and 2007. Now, many people believe that Tobin, who lived in Glasgow until 1969, he turned 23 that year, is Bible John. But they've never been able to confirm it. Well, let's talk about two names that are relatively famous in their own way, Sacco and Vanzetti. Well, in April 1920, witnesses saw the guard of a shoe factory gunned down by two men who stole $15,773 in cash. Now, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti were two Italian immigrants, and they were known anarchists. When the police stopped them on a streetcar, they were armed and evasive when questioned. And when the police learned that Sacco hadn't gone to work on the day of the shoe factory killings, they were both arrested for murder. At the trial, prosecution witnesses confirmed Sacco and Vanzetti were at the scene of the crime, and the prosecution's gun expert said the men owned the type of guns used in the murders. Defense countered with alibis. Sacco was seen in Boston getting a passport, and Vanzetti was seen selling fish. Experts for the defense contradicted prosecution's gun experts and insisted the defendant's guns had been used in the murders. And the trial became international news when defense lawyers claimed Sacco and Vanzetti were being targeted because they were poor immigrants who held unpopular political views. Well, after the trial, they were both found guilty, which caused an uproar in the U.S., Europe, and South America. And over the years, researchers have continued to question that verdict. But modern ballistic tests have revealed that a bullet from Sacco's gun killed the guard. A lot of historians contend that Vanzetti was likely innocent but refused to turn on his guilty comrades, including Sacco. Sometimes when you try to do what's honorable, it comes back and bites you. And that's the case. Well, let's talk about the Black Dahlia. Her name was Elizabeth Short. Moved west to chase stardom, but never quite found success as an actor. But she did become famous for one thing, being the murder victim of one of Hollywood's most notorious unsolved cases. Now, she was a beautiful young lady. On the morning of January 15, 1947, a woman was out walking near an abandoned field in L.A. As she walked by it, she spotted what she thought was a broken mannequin lying in the overgrown weeds. Well, she thought she'd take a closer look and discovered it wasn't a mannequin at all. It was the body of Elizabeth Short. Now, the corpse had been cleanly cut in half and laid carefully posed in the grass. But there wasn't a drop of blood found at the location. It appeared the nude body had been washed before being brought to the lot and abandoned. Her clothes were never found. No personal belongings were found. And was the beginning of one of Hollywood's most gruesome mysteries. And it's unsolved to this day. And it's known as the Black Dahlia murder. Now, the murder caused a sensation in L.A. Police were baffled, and the press sensationalized the case by covering every angle and detail. It was nicknamed the Black Dahlia murder because it was Short's nickname, in reference to her jet black hair and fondness for wearing dark clothing. A month after her body was found, the L.A. Examiner got a strange package with a note. Here's the Dahlia's belongings, letter to follow. And inside the package, they found Short's social security card, her birth certificate, business cards, address book, photographs of her with various men, and claim checks for suitcases she had stowed at the bus depot. Now, the police later determined all the items in the package had been carefully washed with gasoline to remove any fingerprints. But nevertheless, they painstakingly hunted down every lead, but to no avail. And the letters, when they came, contained no useful clues. At first, the leading suspect was a man named Robert Manley, the last person known to see Short alive. They'd actually spent the night together in a hotel. Now, the next day, Short told Manley she's going home to Massachusetts and asking for a ride to the Biltmore Hotel while she's meeting her sister. Well, Manley dropped her off there, and the last time he saw her, he said she was speaking on the lobby telephone. After extensive interrogation and two passed polygraph tests, the police cleared Manley of any involvement. Nevertheless, the interrogation took a toll on Manley, who eventually suffered a nervous breakdown and was committed to a psychiatric hospital. And to complicate matters, the police were inundated with false confessions. Some people just like to do that. They hear about a crime, they run and confess. More than 50 confessing Sams, as they're called, confessed to the murder and cost the police valuable time trying to rule them out. No strong leads emerged, and the case has remained open ever since. One of the most recent tell-all books, a man said his father, a former police officer, was actually the killer. But nothing ever came of it. Well, let's talk about a popularly circulated crime story. A young woman finished shopping at the mall and walks out to her car to go home. There's an old lady sitting in the car. And the old lady says, she tells the old lady, "I'm sorry, this isn't your car." And the old woman says, "I know, but I had to sit down." Well, she asked the young woman for a ride home, and the young woman agreed, but then she remembered she locked the car before she went into the mall. So how'd the old lady get in it? She pretends to go back into the mall to get her sister and returns with a security guard. The guard and the old lady eventually get into a fight, and in the struggle, the old lady's wig falls off, revealing she's actually a man. Well, the police arrive and take the man away, and under the car seat, they find an axe. Well, the truth behind this story, it came from the early 80s and put the action at numerous malls, New York, Las Vegas, Milwaukee, Chicago, and even Fresno, California. Folklorists speculate the tale may date all the way back to the 1834 newspaper account of a gentleman in his carriage who, on opening the supposed female's reticle, finds he's looking at a pair of loaded pistols. Folks like to make stuff up. Why? I don't know, but they do. Well, let's talk about an unwitting accomplice. 2003, a mental health caseworker is driving a patient named Nicholas York around to do some errands. Now, York had been kicked out of a motel the night before, so the caseworker was taking him over to another motel. On the way, York said he needed to withdraw some money from the bank, so the caseworker pulled into the parking lot, and there York went inside. Well, a few minutes later, York got back in the car, and they drove away. But the driver noticed bank workers came outside and were watching them drive off. The caseworker waved as he pulled onto the street and headed for the motel, and a few minutes later, after he dropped off York, the caseworker got a phone call. The bank had been robbed, and the getaway car was a county-issued vehicle. Well, the caseworker led the police to the motel where he dropped off York, and they found him and all the money. Now, another interesting case, similar in nature. A man was being given a ride by his mother and asked her to let him run into the bank for a moment. Well, while he was in the bank, the mother parked the car to go into a store nearby. So the guy robs the bank, runs out to jump in his getaway car, driven by his mother, and finds no car. So he takes off running. Eventually, he was caught, and he blamed his mother for it, of course. Well, in the midst of a bitter divorce in 2013, Randolph Smith came up with a unique way to annoy his soon-to-be ex-wife. When she got home that afternoon, she found a pipe bomb on the kitchen table with a note that read, "This is an explosive. It's a bomb," and written directly on the table, it said, "Boom!" His wife called 911. Police determined the bomb was fake and tracked Smith down at a nearby Burger King, and they arrested him. When I asked him why I did it, he said, "She pissed me off." Is that illegal? As a matter of fact, yeah, it is. Well, in 1985, Kirk Noble Bloodsworth, 23, went on trial for the 1984 sexual assault murder of a 9-year-old girl in Maryland. Bloodsworth pleaded innocent, of course. No physical evidence linked him to the crime, and he had witnesses who put him someplace else at the time of the crime. And despite all that, he was found guilty and sentenced to death. Well, he went up on appeal, and the original conviction was overturned. But during a second trial, he was convicted again. Well, 7 years passed, and in 1992, he saw a book that talked about DNA testing. He told his lawyer about it, who then contacted the Innocence Project. The Innocence Project was able to determine the biological evidence, that biological evidence had been taken in his case. And in April 1992, the prosecutor agreed to have DNA testing done. And DNA testing conclusively proved Bloodsworth could not have been the person who committed the crime for which he'd been convicted twice and for which he'd already served 8 years, two of them on death row. So the conviction was overturned. Well, the real rapist and killer in the Bloodsworth case wasn't discovered for another 10 years after Bloodsworth's exoneration. And when he heard the man's name, Kimberly Shea Ruffner, he said, "My God, I know that person." Ruffner spent 5 years in the same prison as Bloodsworth. Bloodsworth said, "I gave him library books. He never said a word. He should have told me he's the one that committed the crime." Well, from no parking zones to no smoking zones, sometimes it looks like our society has too many rules and regulations. And those of us that remember don't remember life used to be like that. But, you know, during the Middle Ages, public humiliation was a favorite way of teaching miscreants a lesson. You might have heard about the practice of putting people in stocks or in the pillory in a town square for their offenses, but there were a few variations. Bakers who sold loaves of bread that were too light for the advertised size were put in something called a baker's cage or a baker's chair, which is a seesaw device that dunked the baker in a pond. The number of dunkings was determined by the difference between the wrong weight and the right weight. Then women who beat their husbands had to ride an ass through town facing backward. And if the husband hadn't tried to defend himself, he had to lead the ass. Well, the question is, which one was the ass? Well, lovers whose lascivious conduct had gone too far for the town authorities were sentenced in an interesting way. The seducer had to push the seducee through the streets in a wheelbarrow while own workers were encouraged to throw garbage at him. Certainly it was an interesting result. And men who spent too much time and money on drink are paraded through town wearing a barrel painted with humiliating pictures. Then a double iron collar was fastened around the necks of quarreling women who then had to stand locked together in public till they agreed to stop bickering and keep the peace. Well, pity the bungling musician who committed the terrible crime of playing music badly. He was tied to the pillar in a town square with his neck encased in a shame flute. It was an iron neck restraint with an instrument attached. Then there are the what we'll call mask of shame. These were iron masks that came in a variety of shapes designed to portray the person's offense. A gossip wore an iron mask with a long tongue, and a person who stuck his nose into his neighbor's business wore a mask with a huge nose. If you behaved like a pig, you wore a pig's mask in public. Now, the mask hid the wearer's face, of course, but in the small towns of the Middle Ages, where everybody knew everybody, there was no anonymity. And to make sure the townspeople came out for the public humiliation, the mask was fitted with large bells on top to announce the presence of a new victim. So the next time you play an instrument poorly, have a little too much to drink, or misweigh your bread, be happy you live in a 21st century. A century that's known for its my own darn business. Well, let's talk about the boss of all bosses, Lucky Luciano. Born in 1897, he moved to New York from Sicily when he was 9. His Sicilian heritage put him in good stead with Joe the Boss Messeria, head of one of the most powerful gangs in New York. 1929, Messeria was at war with Salvatore Maranzano, the head of a rival gang. And each man wanted to be the capo di tutti capo, or the boss of all bosses. And since Luciano looked for Messeria, Maranzano's men attacked him and left him for dead. Well, instead of seeking revenge, Luciano cut a deal. He arranged Messeria's execution in 1991, took over from Messeria, and let Maranzano become the boss of all bosses for about 6 months. And then Luciano had Maranzano killed. Can't trust anybody, apparently. With both all bosses gone, Luciano revamped what became known as La Cosa Nostra, this thing of ours. And doing away with the boss of all bosses position, he allowed New York's 5 bosses to run their own crime families. Crime bosses from across the country each held a place in what was called the commission, which settled disputes. Under Luciano, La Cosa Nostra concentrated on making money from gambling, extortion, arson, and labor racketeering, and started investing in legitimate businesses. Well, Luciano's luck ran out in 1935 when the authorities convicted, and a lot of folks say framed him, for running a prostitution ring. Well, Luciano controlled his family, crime family from prison until he was deported to Italy in 1946. See, he was supposed to be in prison for 50 years, but during World War II, he helped control Nazi sabotage on the waterfront, so a grateful country deported him. Died of a heart attack in Naples in 1962. Well, let's talk about WOAI-TV out of San Antonio. They had an interesting story. A man with 2 sticks demanded money at a food mart in San Antonio, Texas. So employees and customers who didn't think the man was serious laughed at him. Well, he left, went to a beauty supply store down the street and demanded money there. When a female employee said she didn't have any money, the man started hitting the cash register with sticks. With the sticks. Woman told him to stop and out of her own pocket gave him $2. Well, having gotten his $2, he left. Nobody got hurt. Then there were armed robbers who chased a money courier at high speed before shooting at his vehicle and forced him to stop on a road in Grenau, Germany. Forcing the trunk open, one of the crooks snatched the case before fleeing. But instead of getting money, he actually took the first aid kit. Police spokesman Johann Steinlitz said if there was an award for the dumbest crooks, these two'd get it. Well, let's talk about the many disappearances along what's known as the Highway of Tears. Dotted along a desolate stretch of freeway in northern California, Canada, are billboards that read, "Girls don't hitchhike on the Highway of Tears. Killer is on the loose." Well, from 1970 to the present day, numerous women have been murdered or simply gone missing on what's been dubbed the Highway of Tears. This is a 450-mile-long stretch of Highway 16 between the towns of Prince George and Prince Rupert in British Columbia. The Mounties said the number of people killed or missing is 18, but Native leaders in the region, and several of the victims came from what's known as the First Nations, say the numbers are a lot higher, possibly up into the 50s. While nobody believes all the murders are linked, police have indicated they believe a serial killer is responsible for at least some of them, in fact, possibly several of the attacks. Some even believe the many disappearances are a result of multiple serial killers operating in the same area. While there have been suspects in the case, nobody's ever been arrested. Resources invested in solving this mystery have been drastically reduced over the years, as you might guess, but the case is still open. Well, in 1997, Minneapolis native Tom Tipton got the thrill of his life when he was invited to sing the national anthem before a Minnesota Vikings football game. Across town, an off-duty sheriff was watching the pregame show and recognized Tipton's name. Turns out Tipton was wanted on two warrants in Minneapolis. He got arrested during the game, didn't get to see the end of it. 2006, Robert Russell Moore of Maryland was charged with the robbery of an Arby's restaurant where he was recently employed. At the subsequent trial, four of his former fellow employees testified, although he's wearing a mask, they recognized Moore in surveillance tapes, especially when he bent over and they recognized his butt crack sticking out above the top of his pants. Former manager also testified he had talked to Moore repeatedly about his butt crack problem. Well, based on that identification, Moore was sentenced to 10 years in prison. 1999, a man wearing a long dark coat and a mask walked into the Royal Casino in Aberdeen, South Dakota, pointed a gun at the clerk, and demanded money. Next day, local man Gerald Neeson, 44, was arrested for the crime. Neeson was a regular at the casino, and the clerk had recognized that distinctively powerful odor of his cologne. Well, he got 7 years in prison and hopefully changed his cologne. Well, they don't give judges awards for creativity. Maybe they should. Edward Bellows, 60, a vending machine repairman and small-time crook, was involved in a conspiracy to use stolen credit cards with which he racked up more than $26,000 in charges. Federal District Court Judge Alvin Hellerstein sentenced Bellows to 10 months of home detention with no TV. The two-free environment would create a condition of silent introspection that I consider necessary to induce the defendant to change his behavior. Well, despite a 30-year history of committing petty crimes, Bellows never spent a day in prison, says he was grateful to the judge for sparing him from the slammer one more time. But he did appeal the no TV sentence, claiming it's a form of censorship and violates his First Amendment rights. According to Bellows, a television sort of like your umbilical cord to life. If that cord's cut, you got a problem. Well, then there's Albert Brown, a repeat drug offender in San Francisco, California. And his crime, which bordered on stupidity, was selling drugs to an undercover cop. Rather than decide the sentence himself, Judge James Warren of San Francisco gave Brown one of his judicial robes and told him to put it on. He said, "This is your life, you're your own judge, so sentence yourself." Brown gave himself 6 months in jail. Then, according to news reports, he tacked on a string of self-imposed conditions, such as cleaning up for his kids and steering clear of the neighborhood where he got busted. Well, the probation department recommended 6 months and a good lecturing, Warren told reporters, but I figured I'm not that good at lecturing. He, on the other hand, is very good at lecturing himself. And maybe this time it'll stick. I had the transcripts typed up and sent over to him just in case he forgot. Then there was Alan Law, 19, of Derwent, Ohio. He disturbed the peace by driving through town with his truck windows rolled down and a stereo blasting. Municipal Court Judge John Nicholson gave Law a choice. Pay a $100 fine or sit and listen to polka music for 4 hours. Law chose to face the music. A few days later, he reported to the police station and was locked in an interview room where he listened to the Blue Skirt Waltz, Who Stole the Kishka, the Two Fat Polka, and other hits by Cleveland polka artist Frankie Yankovic. Well, Law managed to sit through it all and then abandoned his plans to buy an even louder stereo for his truck. He didn't know what would happen on a second offense. Might be required to listen to waltz music. Well, sometimes folks don't understand what constitutes an emergency. Officer in Janesville, Wisconsin, responded to a 911 call about a domestic disturbance after a husband and wife got into an argument. When they got to the house, the wife explained to the officers the argument started after the husband had inappropriately passed gas while they were tucking their son into bed. When police decided that was not a crime, though it was probably in bad taste or smell or something. Then in July 2006, a sheriff's deputy in Olaha, Oregon, responded to a noise complaint at the home of Lorna Jean Dudash. Spoke to the woman for just a moment and left, and a short time later, Ms. Dudash called 911 and asked if that cutie pie officer could return. She said, "He's the cutest cop I've seen in a long time. I just want to know his name." Well, the confused dispatcher asked her what the emergency was, and she responded, "Honey, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm 45 years old, and I'd like to meet him again." Well, a dispatcher sent the officer back to her house, and he promptly arrested her for abusing the emergency dispatch system. Well, this next one, I saw a special on it the other night. This is about D.B. Cooper. 1972, 4 months after Cooper's successful hijacking, another hijacker stole the plane in Denver, used the same MO as D.B. Cooper. The Denver flight was also a 727 with a rear stairway from which the hijacker made his getaway by parachute. Tip led the police to a man named Richard McCoy Jr., a man with an unusual profile. Married with two children, a former Sunday school teacher, a law enforcement major at Brigham Young University, former Green Beret helicopter pilot with service in Vietnam, and an avid skydiver. Well, the FBI agents arrested McCoy 2 days after the hijacking. Now, what was the evidence they used to arrest him? They found a jumpsuit and duffel bag containing $500,000. He got convicted and sentenced to 45 years. Well, in August 2000, Joe Weber told U.S. News and World Report shortly before her husband Dwayne died in 1995. She said he told her, "I'm Dan Cooper." And then he talked in his sleep about jumping out of a plane, so she looked into his background, discovered he spent time in an Oregon prison. She also found a Northwest Airlines ticket stub from the Seattle-Tacoma Airport among his papers. And she found a book about D.B. Cooper in the local library. It had notations in the margins matching her husband's handwriting. Well, she told FBI agent Ralph Himmelsbach, chief investigator of the Cooper case, and he insisted Weber's one of the likeliest suspects. More recently, facial recognition software was used to find the closest match to the composite picture of Cooper. Of 3,000 photographs used, including Richard McCoy's, Dwayne Weber's was identified as the best match. And then in 2017, a new theory emerged that D.B. Cooper had been identified. He was living in San Diego, California. His name was Robert Rackstraw. That's the one I saw on the special. A former helicopter pilot in the U.S. Army. And though the case was officially closed by the FBI in July 2016, armchair detectives everywhere continued to investigate, claiming they found almost 100 pieces of evidence that linked Rackstraw to the crime. Most of it is circumstantial, though. Now, Rackstraw was identified as a possible suspect in the initial investigation, but was cleared because he was only 28 at the time, much younger than the description given by the flight attendants. And Rackstraw continues to deny any involvement in the 1971 skyjacking. Now, from Dennis Miller, we have this finding. A recent police study found you're much more likely to get shot by a fat cop if you run, because they're not going to chase you. Well, Jack the Ripper, among history's most infamous killers, between August and November of 1888, 5 prostitutes in London were violently murdered that we know about. And despite participation of London City Police and Scotland Yard, interviews with over 1,500 witnesses, and investigation of hundreds of possible suspects, The case was closed in 1892. Unsolved. Well, in 1988, the FBI came up with a criminal profile of Jack the Ripper. They said he was a resident of Whitechapel from a broken home, someone with medical training, such as a barber or a mortician's assistant, single since you could stay out all night stalking women, somebody with a regular job since it killed on the weekends or in the early morning hours, and between the ages of 28 and 36. And they also said he was neat, shy, a loner, and a man who hated women. Well, based on those criteria, the BBC came up with some likely suspects in 2008. Montague Druitt. Now, he didn't match the descriptions of the killer, but he was the son of a doctor, had a history of mental problems, and played cricket tournaments near Whitechapel about the time of the murders. In December of 1888, just weeks after the last victim was found, he drowned himself in the Thames River. The murders stopped after his death, or at least murders stopped in that area. Then there's Prince Albert Victor Christian Edward, or Prince Eddie as he was known, the grandson of Queen Victoria. Now, he wasn't really a suspect till 1970 when a surgeon named Thomas Stahl published an article that implicated him in the crimes. According to Stahl, the prince was driven crazy by syphilis and committed to murders while consumed by madness. And the author also believes the royal family knew the prince was Jack the Ripper and covered it up. Now, none of the papers Stahl cited can be corroborated, and according to logs kept by the royal family, Prince Eddie had alibis for most of the murders. Of course, those alibis could have been part of a cover-up. Then there's Nathan Kaminsky, also known as David Cohen. A few weeks after the last Whitechapel murder, police in the East End discovered a man wandering the streets muttering to himself in Yiddish. He was taken to a lunatic asylum and given the name David Cohen, because they didn't know who he was. He attacked a guard with a lead pipe, spat out food, kicked people who walked by him, and eventually he was confined to his bed and died in the asylum. Turned out that David Cohen was actually a man named Nathan Kaminsky, a cobbler and tailor who had syphilis and was treated in an infirmary that was right in the center of the murderer's domain. Well, supposedly, through brilliant medical activity, Kaminsky was cured in May of 1888 and released. He was released into the East End population at the right time and fit witness descriptions. And once he got incarcerated at the lunatic asylum under the name of David Cohen, the murder stopped. But after 130 years, the identity of Jack the Ripper is still a mystery. Well, sometimes doing the right thing can blow up in your face. Let's look at the story of Richard Jewell, security guard at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, Georgia. He was patrolling Centennial Park at 1 a.m. when he noticed a suspicious bag near where thousands of people were enjoying a concert. Turns out the bag contained three pipe bombs and shrapnel. Jewell called the bomb squad and immediately started evacuating people. A few minutes later, the bombs exploded. Two people were killed and dozens more were injured, but it could have been a whole lot worse. When police called Jewell the heroes, the manhunt for the bomber began. The FBI was under a lot of pressure, which may be why they labeled they leaked a lone bomber criminal profile with a note that Jewell was a person of interest. Well, for the rest of that summer, the FBI and the press followed Jewell wherever he went. Editorials called him a failed cop who planted a bomb and called it in so people would think he was a hero. Well, in 1996, the FBI announced Jewell was no longer a suspect. Jewell sued four news outlets for libel. 2006, he said, "This isn't about the money, it's about clearing my name." Well, in 2003, police arrested Eric Rudolph, who'd also bombed an abortion clinic and a lesbian nightclub in Atlanta. Investigators were able to link him to the Olympic bombings because of the similarities among the design of the bombs. Clint Eastwood has made a movie about it. Well, let's look at how criminal minds work. Most common reasons for hiring a private detective in the U.S. is tracking down somebody who owes you money. 1976, Bruce Springsteen was arrested for trying to climb over the gates of Graceland. John Dillinger, the first criminal designated public enemy number one by the FBI. And did you know that pro wrestler and actor Dwayne The Rock Johnson has a degree in criminology? Now, we've all heard the phrase Confucius say, but who was Confucius? Actually, he became China's minister of crime in 501 BC. Well, as with movies and TV today, a lot of people in 19th century London blamed the growing crime rate on violence in the theaters. And the word alibi actually means elsewhere in Latin. 1969, Neil Young and Jimi Hendrix stole a truck to get to Woodstock in time to perform. Well, the first law school in the United States was Litchfield Law School in Connecticut, established in 1773. Three of its graduates you probably heard of, Aaron Burr, Horace Mann, and John C. Calhoun. Now, the original Draconian, that's somebody who's extremely harsh, was Draco of Athens, executed people for stealing cabbage. Then Mary Jenkins Surratt was the first woman executed by the U.S. government. She was hung in 1865 for conspiracy to assassinate President Abraham Lincoln. And does anyone know what crime led Billy the Kid to his first run-in with the law? It was stealing cheese. He was 15 years old. His second crime was stealing laundry from a Chinese laundry. Well, a man named Dylan Osborne, 37, of Buckinghamshire, England, he joined Facebook in 2007, and a window appeared on the screen to ask if he wanted to send friend requests to everybody on his email list, and he said yes. Well, a friend request went out to his estranged wife, Claire Tarbox, but he was under court order not to have any contact with her. So Tarbox called police, and Osborne was arrested for sending a friend request and sentenced by a judge to 10 days in jail. Osborne claimed he didn't understand how Facebook works and had no idea the request would be sent to Tarbox. He told reporters after his release, "I didn't even know she had a Facebook account. To be honest, I don't think the judge understood how it works either." And let's talk about these next folks. Vanessa Starr Palm, 23, of Illinois, and Alexander Daniel Russ, 24, of Indiana. While the two were on vacation in the Bahamas in 2009, they saw a wild iguana, and they killed it. Then they cooked it and ate it. Then they took photos of the whole process and put them on Facebook. Well, in the Bahamas, iguanas are an endangered species, and somebody contacted the authorities about the photos, and the Bahamian police tracked them down and arrested the couple. Well, they got out of jail on a $500 bail and eventually paid fines for their illegal meal. Well, decades before Jack Kevorkian, John Bodkin Adams earned the moniker Dr. Death for being a suspected serial killer and master manipulator. He convinced his elderly patients, or should I say victims, to change their will so he could benefit from their death, which resulted in a doozy of a conflict of interest case. In 1922, he took up a general practice in the sleepy British town of Eastbourne, known as a pleasant retirement location for the well-to-do. And over the course of more than 20 years, he managed to treat 163 patients who suffered suspicious deaths. Of those 163, 132 left him money or other items in their wills. Now, folks began to suspect through his treatment he managed to ease the passing of his patients by keeping them in suspended states of disability through drugs. In one particular case, utilizing a cocktail of heroin and morphine is supposedly remedying a woman's discomfort after a stroke. Although that particular patient, Edith Alice Morrell, left Adams out of her will, he still managed to claim a small amount of money some silverware, and a Rolls Royce. Well, by 1956, Adams is one of the wealthiest doctors in England. And in July of that year, police were finally tipped off to the dirty dealings of Dr. Death, thanks to an anonymous call from the friend of a victim. Police learned about Adams' preferred technique of administering special injections to his patients, which never took place in the presence of a nurse, and he never explained to anybody what was in those concoctions. Well, this trial began in March of 1957, splashed across the front page of newspapers worldwide as the murder trial of the century. After 44 minutes of deliberation, he was found not guilty. Now, he was convicted of lesser charges in a separate trial, but he managed, but at least they did take away his license to practice medicine. 1961, he's reinstated as a general practitioner. His authority to prescribe dangerous drugs was given back to him a year later. He died in 83 from complications due to an injury suffered while shooting clay pigeons. One of those clay pigeons apparently dropped a brick on him. December 8, 1980, John Lennon was shot and killed while walking into his New York City apartment building. Now, before that night, Lennon had claimed the building was haunted. And Yoko Ono, who still lives there, says her late husband's become one of the Dakota's resident ghosts. One night, she saw an apparition of him sitting at his piano. He looked up at her and said, "Don't worry, Yoko, I'm still with you." Well, let's talk about not taking it at face value. In 2012, Dakota Guerin and Elizabeth Massman, both 19, were hired to clean a house in Vancouver, Washington. After they left, the homeowner noticed her valuable coin collection was missing. Guerin denied everything. He told the police, "You don't have any evidence on him," and they let him go. But last, the public would be on the lookout for any rare coins. A week later, a movie theater employee called police to report that a young couple paid for their tickets with quarters from the 1930s. Turns out they'd been using the coins worth between $1,000 and $18,500 each at face value to buy pizza and play video games. Well, Guerin and Massman were arrested. Most, if not all, the valuable coins were recovered, but sometimes you have to wonder about folks. In 2012, Ray Rosinski, 25, a hotel worker in Scottsdale, Arizona, reported a bomb threat. Well, when the police arrived, he said there was no longer any danger because the person who made the threat promised to leave in exchange for a large sum of money. Rodzinski said he gave the man $290 of the hotel's money and he's long gone, so you guys can leave. Well, officers didn't believe it, and they asked Rodzinski if they could search his car, and he said yes, and lo and behold, when the officers took off the gas cap, $290 fell out. Rodzinski said later, "I don't know why I thought this was a good idea, but I did." Well, ever wonder how fingerprinting came about? In 1905, store manager Thomas Farrell was dead from a beating, and his wife Anne, who was unconscious, would die a few days later. The shop and living space above the shop was ransacked, and the police found an empty cash box with greaser fingerprints lying on the floor. Suspicion fell on Alfred and Albert Stratton, 22 and 20, respectively. Neither had an arrest record, but locals claimed they were thieves, and the milkman thought he had seen them nearby at the time of the murders, but failed to identify them after their arrest. Authorities thought it was a little strange of convicting the brothers of murder till they took their fingerprints and discovered that Alfred's print matched the one on the cash box. Well, in 1905, fingerprints were a new forensic tool, and prosecutors weren't sure that a jury would accept them as sufficient evidence, let alone the evidence that would hang two men. So the trial hinged on testimony from forensic expert Inspector Collins, who explained how Alfred's prints had actually matched those of the cash box by tracing and comparing the ridges, and how the two impressions corresponded exactly. Well, the verdict was guilty. With the fingerprints accepted as a method of identification in a murder case, this was the beginning of using forensic science to establish guilt or innocence. Both Alfred and Albert were hung. Now, Albert claimed that he should have been warned by police that fingerprints could be used to identify him. And in the case of Ted Bundy, the only physical evidence that linked him to his crimes was the bite marks on the young ladies. Well, you know, sometimes it's clear that being a judge is no guarantee that a person has good judgment. Let's look at Sharon Killer Keller, the presiding judge on the Texas Criminal Court of Appeals. 2007, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case on the constitutionality of lethal injection to execute condemned prisoners. Michael Richard was to be executed in Texas that night, and Richard's lawyers wanted to request a stay of execution based on Supreme Court's actions, but they had computer problems. Shortly before 5 p.m., they called the Court of Appeals and asked if it could remain open a few minutes past closing time so they could file their papers. Judge Keller said, "Well, tell them we close at 5, and the lawyers missed the deadline, and he was executed a few hours later. Well, Keller was eventually charged with 5 counts of misconduct relating to that case. Her other claim to fame, authoring a 1997 opinion that denied a new trial to a man serving 99 years for aggravated rape after DNA tests, excluded him as a suspect in the crime. She told interviewers, "We can't give new trials to everybody who establishes after conviction he might be innocent." Duh. Then in 2010, Keller was fined $100,000 for failing to list more than $2.8 million in assets on his financial disclosure forms. Mere oversight, don't you know? Then in the early 1960s, Renee Castellani was working for radio station CKNW in Vancouver, Canada. He is known for his publicity stunts. To help the BOMAC car dealership sell more automobiles, he stayed perched on top of the 10-story BOMAC sign for 8 days, vowing not to leave till every car was sold. He also once posed as an Indian prince and drove around town in a limousine with bodyguards and dancing girls. Well, he was actually described as a devoted husband. He brought his wife, Esther, a daily treat of vanilla milkshake. Well, in 1965, Esther's health began to fail with each shake she drank. Started to get stomach and lower back pains that kept her out of work. And about this time, she found a love letter in Renee's pocket and confronted him about it. But her health was the bigger concern. She began to have bouts of nausea, diarrhea, and intense vomiting. Her fingers and toes went numb. She couldn't walk or use her hands. For 2 months, she was hospitalized as doctors puzzled over her condition. They couldn't find the answer or the cure. In August of 1965, she died at age 40, leaving behind her husband and their 12-year-old daughter. Well, it turns out Renee was carrying on an affair with a strawberry blonde receptionist at the radio station, and he intended to marry her, but he needed Esther out of the way. Instead of asking for a divorce, he opted for murder. The autopsy revealed that she had 1,500 times the normal level of arsenic in her body. Medical examiners determined she had been ingesting it for more than 6 months, including while she was in the hospital. So where was she getting it? Those daily milkshake deliveries from her husband. Police searched the Castellani home and found Triox weed killer beneath the kitchen sink. It was missing the exact amount of poison that had been estimated to have been in Esther's body. And her hair held more evidence. Scientists could chart the amount of arsenic she consumed each day from a strand of her long black hair. And curiously, the hair revealed that during the 8 days that Renee was on top of the BOMAC sign, when the milkshake deliveries were interrupted, there was no sign of poison in her system. About 3 months after the murder, Renee applied for a license to marry the receptionist. 2 days later, the police arrested him. They convicted him of murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison. It didn't say if he actually married the girl or not. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow when we will once again be talking about strange crimes. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.